Flight Commander reserved that for himself. Well, wouldn't you? Oh, yes. Very, very well. Then you, your own flight, your own squadron saw that aircraft come up. You knew that your C flight commander or B flight commander or A flight commander. You could see one glance without waiting to read his wretched letters. You could see that 100 yards away.
So you, as a regular pilot, though, wouldn't do that to your plane?
Not until I became flight commander.
Not until you became flight commander. Okay, that's what I was after. Thank you.
I'll show you over here. I'll show you a plane.
Now, I'm thinking of, would you be using incendiary bullets as well as...
No.
No incendiary bullets?
Well, I won't say there weren't any used in the flying corps, but we didn't use them. We used ordinary... We selected our ammunition very carefully, and we also... The pilots, as I told you, I worked very closely with my armor and everything that was done, because that's tremendously important. We got a good armor-piercing type of bullet, and we tried them on the range until we got the ammunition in our ground ranges, in our ground guns. I was constantly on the range when I wasn't flying to make sure what your guns are doing. There's no use of firing ammunition in the air unless you know what the things are doing. And the ammunition varied. Different types of ammunition did different jobs better. Now, we had an ammunition that was called Buckingham. And if you were out to after a dump, a bombing dump, that sort of thing, and you bombed the dump and you wanted to set the thing alight to get real action, you used the ammunition that would do it.
Mm-hmm.
And the Buckingham ammunition. Now,
you as an individual pilot could make that decision, though.
No, your flight commander made that decision.
The flight commander again made the decision.
Yes, well, naturally, because these are poor boys just coming in. They had enough to worry about other than... So when I became a flight commander, I tried to act as a flight commander.
Parachutes?
There were none.
Period.
No, there were no parachutes. Well, excuse me. Do you want to waste time on that?
Well, I don't think it's a waste of time. No.
All right. I'll tell you quickly.
Sure.
There were parachutes there. For example, the balloons.
Balloon men, yeah.
Yes, they had parachutes. But they always were two, at least two, because some of them didn't open. Some of them didn't open. And wait a minute. It wasn't funny, because I know the chief of the Boom Boom Trenchard came down. He wanted to get us to use these damn things. They were available. And he said, I can't get them to build an aircraft for them if he won't use them. And then they tried to get somebody to try one out in the squadron. And they said, well, you can't sit on the damn thing. And he said, oh, you could do that with a light load of gasoline. They call it petrol. Why don't you do it? And he finally turned to me and said, well, come on, you've been doing these things around here. Why don't you? What about you? And I said, well, I'll do one. If you will take that two-seater you brought the thing in here and let them give me a demonstration. I want to see how it works. I've never seen one work, and I want to see it from the ground. I want a demonstration. You want me to do it? Give me a demonstration. So up there... He said, do you mean a man to jump out? I said, oh, no, in this small field, we want to see it come down here, let him throw it out with the weight. You don't need to have a man jump out. I don't think that's necessary. As long as I see that the damn thing works and how it works. They sent up the thing and the damn thing came down and turned open. He jumped in the car and then drove away before I could... He didn't comment. So that ended. So far as I know, there was no fighter plane on the Western Front built to equip for parachutes because no one.
Unreliable or?
Well, no, there were no.
Well, you see, what I'm getting at is the attitude, too.
Well, the attitude is this. Until they produced one that we had confidence in, how are you going to gain confidence? The first parachute that was built was in the early 20s, after the war, by the Americans called the Guardian Angel, that we knew about. The Guardian Angel was the first one we had any confidence in. And from there on in, we changed in the flying corps, in the the Canadian Air Force by that time. We changed in the Canadian Air Force, and even out on operations, we started to use parachutes. Well, of course, parachutes are beautiful in a land plane, but isn't on a seaplane or a float plane or a flying boat. They became a damn nuisance because if you're going to land in the water, what's the difference? And then furthermore, if your aircraft had an accident, this damn parachute attached to you, and you turned upside down, one or two of our pilots got drowned, and we were quite satisfied that they hadn't been tagged with a damn parachute, they'd probably got free. So we...
The feeling on the Western Front, though, in 1917, was to leave your parachutes with the balloonists. Is that correct?
No. The aircraft that were equipped for them, the bombers and the bigger airplane, they could do as they damn well please. But as far as the fighter planes, I'm only talking about fighter planes now. Mm-hmm. I'm not fully conversant, but it may well be that the big Handley Pages did do okay, because they could carry all the load. And
monstrous planes, eh?
I flew them later on after the war, but they were dreadful to fly. Frightened the life out of me.
Okay. What I'm trying to get at now, if we can, is if we could go on operations now with the squadron. I've been asking general questions, if you will, and then we go on to going out on patrol and engaging the enemy and the types of things you did. And I was thinking of that, what, the flick or power flick role, and the description of that in that letter that you wrote might be helpful there.
It'd be very hard for me to describe it that quickly, but as briefly as I can, concisely as I can, with the rotary engine, with any engine, with a propeller on it, the propeller evolving, it as soon as it gains speed and all the power that it, and the thrust and everything else, it develops what is called a torque. So in the just due to its rotation, it wants to go. The torque is normally about at approximately 90 degrees off to one side or the other in accordance with the direction of the rotation. Mm-hmm. So that's torque. But on a stationary engine, in a stationary engine, the engine is still and the propeller is turning around. It is in your car. Early the crankshaft is in your car. Now with a rotary engine, the propeller is not attached to the crankshaft. The crankshaft is stationary. The engine rotates around the crankshaft. So the propeller has not only got the torque that it develops due to itself, but it also has a fantastic centrifugal action, which due to the weight of the engine, infinitely, 100 times greater than the propeller. And they're both in the same direction. Now, at least they can be,
in the case of the engine, the
clergy and the Lerone, they're all that same direction. So you had you had not only the torque to contend with, but you had the fantastic additional strength of the centrifugal action in the same direction, which meant that the aircraft would turn so rapidly in one direction. You could you'd turn on a sixpence and give them back a half a crown and change. Or turn on a dime and
have a dollar and change.
A whole buck and change.
The thing is that tactically, one of your best tactics was this power.
Well, no, it's only a defensive tactic.
Defensive tactic is what I was getting at.
In your offensive, so long as you were in a position to hit and strike, it is useless. Because what are you trying to do?
But
if the enemy gets the drop on you, suppose you go in dropping bombs on which we were forced to do during that March offensive. We were ordered, that's all we were ordered to do, go and blow up bridges the bombers couldn't get. We had to go right in low and lay our eggs right on, practically on the bridge. Well, then you were a sitting duck for any aircraft that came in to attack you. Now, that was one position, one item. But that happened anywhere, that you were at a disadvantage with the enemy having the greater height, or he's just smarter than you were up to that time and got in and was firing at you. And what you want to do is to get the heck away from where he thought you were going to be. And do it quick. That was the only purpose that Quigley ever gave us on the power flick roll, which is his baby.
And this is this fellow Quigley.
Frank Quigley. Frank Ranger Quigley.
Was the sea flight commander.
That's right.
Developed this tactic.
As far as I know,
as far as you know. And taught you this as a flight.
As part of his, I was his number two in the team, and he selected me for it. He decided, I guess, that I was dumb enough that I could do it.
So the idea behind it, I'm just trying to make sure that whoever listens to this understands, is that if you were caught from behind, you were in front and someone was behind, you would do this power flick roll. And what that would be you'd fire on the power, bring the nose up a bit.
Well, now...
Give it full rudder. No.
What you're aiming to do was to get the heck out of the road, but not to get out of the battle. You wanted to completely confuse the enemy by, you did a 360-degree roll, but it was a flick roll, a power flick roll. Now, they talk about a slow roll, and I used to do the slow roll too, but in a slow roll, you fly your aircraft all the way around, and you're flying it all the way, and it's fairly fast, but it's very, very slow as compared to the flick roll. The flick roll, you do 360 degrees and do it as a flick, and you come out right side up with your guns firing.
And therefore, fellow coming down on you would overshoot because...
Wherever behind, you weren't where he was firing at all. You shouldn't be where he was going to fire at. You're completely, but if you were smart enough to come out firing and right side up and you knew exactly where to cut the power off and where to put it on again, you could do it 360 degrees and
come out firing.
And that is Quigley's great stunt, and he was able to do it, and he taught us how to do it.
Now you got a number of you shot down a number of aircraft doing that.
Yes.
Well,
that was one way. But it didn't happen to too many, but a few.
You got a few that way,
yourself. And I avoided being shot down myself.
Well, many times.
which was a good tactic.
Okay. Hey, we take a break here.
Yes, by all means.
Okay. We've run out of time today. I'd like to thank you, Air Vice Marshal Haslam, for making the time. And next day, if I could, we'd pick up on the operational level of 70 Squadron and your time in France. During the first war,
that's
agreeable
with you, sir. Yeah, those notes that I gave you had to do with 70 Squadron only. Of course, after I was wounded, I went back to France again on Snipes in 43 Squadron, and I was there at the end of the war from several months, and then went up to the Rhine in the Army of Occupation for a while. But that had nothing to do with 70 Squadron. I went to 43 Squadron on Snipes, the big sister of the Camel. And we were talking about that former time with Frank Quigley, that had to do with 70 Squadron only.
Well, what I thought next time is we would do 70 Squadron, the Great March Offensive of 1918,
yes.
And then you're being wounded, and then getting back into action again and tie off the war if we can, sir.
Okay.
Sounds good. Thank you very much, sir.
Thank you.